This Saturday, Dessa will be performing at the House of Blues for Heavy and Light, a combination of talks and music to help people dealing with depression and suicidal thoughts. Dessa is a rapper and performer both on her own and with the Doomtree Collective. She talked with 90.7's Abe Abaraya. Dessa started the conversation talking about the organization To Write Love on Her Arms, which is putting on Saturday's event.
But when you're really in the throes of something, you know, when you're in the throes of looping thoughts or it's late at night and compulsive impulses seem to be kind of hijacking your thinking, it's really important to have a place to reach out to. And so To Write Love on Our Arms, like the work that they've done to make resources available and also just to collect a community of people, you know, to support people who are really struggling with those issues, I think makes a lot of sense and resonates with me personally. You know, I've been frank about the fact that I've had some struggles with cyclothymia, which is like a baby version of bipolar.
Triple threat. I'm not some method actress trying to see my descent. You're gonna have to play the tape back with save that breath for choir practice. Got no time for my detractors standing on my staircase. All you want is a fire hazard.
Well, you've got this album coming out that you recorded with the Minnesota Orchestra. I wanted to ask, what's the biggest challenge when you're collaborating with an entire orchestra?
I didn't grow up like playing in band or singing in choir or anything. So not only had I never performed with an orchestra before, but I didn't really have a strong precedent for just like large group ensembles, you know, of instrumentalists. I've performed a lot with my cohorts in Doomtree, which is like kind of like a ragtag. It's a rap crew, you know, so it's big personalities, a lot of talent. But our music generally isn't notated, and our performances don't like necessitate hours and hours and hours of rehearsal.
My husband kind of fit. I'm the famous,
red eyes shining. But working with an orchestra, I mean, you know, this is like an order of magnitude larger. I mean, it's just like over 75 people on stage at one time doing the same thing. I mean, that it's staggering. Don't see too many
rivals. You released Chime in 2018, and this is a little bit of the song Fire Drills. I want to play a little bit of that as well. Don't give me visuals. By definition, you can't make a difference. It's a big ambition. You're simply standing sentry to your innocence. That's not a way to live. That can't be what a woman is. That gives enough room to aspire to. What that is, it's just a life of running fire drills. That's a song about growing up as a girl that's being told to be safe, it's being told to be cautious. I want to maybe flip the question a little bit and ask, what advice would you have for fathers out there that are maybe trying to strike that balance between keeping their girls safe and sort of letting kids grow up just being kids?
Oh man, that's such a good question. I want to be careful because I'm not a parent, so I don't want to step out of my lane of expertise. But I think that some of the best work that we can do to keep girls safe is to raise boys well, you know? So it's not only how you raise your girls, but how you raise your boys. I went on a date like two nights ago where I came home and I laughed at myself because I'd been, I had not lived up to my own feminist standards of like, just frank conversation and an honest self-advocacy. I'd been kind of pressured into a kiss that I didn't want to have. I'm 38 years old. Like, I'm on record as a feminist. You know what I mean? Like, and I I'm laughing because I didn't feel unsafe. I'm laughing because I thought, wow, it is hard to put in practice what is so easy to speak about. But in the moment, I don't know, like, I didn't know what else to say, and I got awkward, and so I just gave in. And that's silly, because that's not what I do in business negotiations, right? When you walk down a street, for example, you know, you're aware of how the shadows are being cast. When you approach an overhead light, you know that your shadow is falling behind you. I don't like that moment because I can't see if there's a shadow that's falling ahead of me from behind, right? So I like it much better when I know that a street light is behind me, because then I'd have a little early warning, you know, if someone happened to be walking behind me. To learning how to hold her keys, to making sure that she texts her friend when she's home, you know, all of that, very reasonable precautions that we take. If you could sweep all that time together and make a snowball of it, and then spend it doing anything else, you could learn another language. I mean, you could learn how to program, you know, like, it's the opportunity cost, even when you win, you know what I mean? It's like a lousy game.
We don't say go out and be brave. Now we say be careful, stay safe. In any given instance, that don't hurt. It sinks in like stilettos in soft earth. Like the big win is not a day without an incident.
I just wanted to say, I think it's worth filing a report of all the things we're not doing because we're preoccupied with that. And my tenor wasn't, I hope, blamey. My tenor was, hey, I think as other human beings might be interested in this corner of human experience that isn't transcribed too often, both men and women. This is an angle that seems worth thinking about for a moment, you know? And so I think one of the moments that I'm of genuine, like, real highest praise that I've received as an artist is when dads sing along to that in concert. Like, that means a lot. I'd love for travel books not to have a section at the back that says advice for women traveling alone. Like, what a weird thing it is, I guess, to go unremarked upon.
Well, I want to switch topics just a little bit. So you were the CEO of Doomtree Records, and obviously that's not an easy position to rise to. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the decision to leave that.
So, you know, Doomtree is a 7-member collective from Minneapolis, and it started when the founding members were, like, you know, in their late teens, essentially. I joined in my early 20s on their invitation. So, you know, in the beginning, when I was CEO, that title, I don't know, it might as well have been, like, written in magic marker on my sippy cup. I mean, we just had to pick somebody who's CEO because they make you do that to file, like, a small business, you know, with the state of Minnesota. But, you know, a lot of us were locomoting on skateboards. Not everybody had a cell phone. And we had a weekly meeting where we would assign jobs. But it was definitely, like, a hybrid between a viable company and, like, a girl/boy scout troop and a rap label, you know. It was pretty chill.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and then it grew as we did, you know. So it was like we sort of learned the business skills that we needed as the show started getting bigger, and hey, we got to figure out how to actually make a bunch of these CDs because we sold out of the last run. So instead of, like, copying them on our mother's computers, like, we should figure out, there's got to be a company who does that, and instead of, like, copying all the album art at, you know, at Kinko's, then we should get it professionally printed. So we, you know, we kind of responded to the need, and then flash forward, you know, over a decade later, we were a real thing. You know, we're touring internationally, and it was about at that time that that another member of the crew, who's a super talented producer, and he'd been, like, a member of other successful bands. His name is Laserbeak, and he and I had been kind of running the business stuff together. But when we really started codifying, you know, a lot of our practices and becoming more serious, he took over. And in part, you know, I was eager to focus on my solo career as well. So he's been the CEO, and I texted him right before this call to ask if I could get, can I get 10 minutes with you on the phone today? I know you're busy. So he's running the ship now. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like it wasn't necessarily, like, you know, a gripping decision to have to say, oh, okay, I'm going to leave as CEO and focus on my career. It sort of sounds almost a little bit natural.
It did, yeah. It did feel really organic, and I think for a lot of indie artists, you know, we do a lot of business stuff, you know, whether it's just, like, a couple of my friends are both, like, the leaders of their bands and just happen to be super talented graphic artists, you know, or illustrators. So it makes sense, like, oh, I'm going to design my own album cover and I'll draw my own t-shirts. And some folks like me, like, I happen to really like business writing as well as, you know, as well as lyric writing. So very often I'll write my own press releases and bios and stuff because I'm available and I'm cheap to hire for me, you know, so.
Here in my paper crown, with a glass of fat champagne, let's bar another round, but I'm the only one who's still awake.
Your music has a niche, as you would call it, that's sort of dealing with love lost. Can you talk about the lengths that you went to get over that?
Oh gosh, for maybe like for over a dozen years, I've been dating on and off one of the dudes in my rap crew. And as you might imagine, it was really tough to get any meaningful distance to heal up from that relationship while you are also in the same car touring around. And a lot of the heartbreak songs that I wrote were about him. We were not super public about that fact because it seems like it would make touring really awkward. And I don't know, there just didn't seem to be a lot gained by being very public about that fact. So I struggled with it privately for a really long time. And then after enough years had passed, A, I was tired of the feeling. B, I felt like I was at risk of retreading very familiar material musically if this was the only thing I could write about. And C, I felt like the disparity between my public presentation. Like, I just didn't like the weight of the secret. The weight of the secret was too much, and it made me feel bad and embarrassed about already a very sad thing. So I ended up moving to New York and trying all the things that you do to get over somebody, and none of them seemed to be working. So after having seen a TED Talk by Dr. Helen Fisher, who had worked with a team of neuroscientists to try to locate the love in the human brain, like to figure out which neuroanatomical structures were involved with romantic love, I wanted to do the same thing. I wanted to see if an fMRI scan could indicate which parts of my brain were most active in my love so that I could try to stop it. And so I worked with a clinician named Penny Jean to see if it were possible to change the way that my brain was behaving.
Did it work?
I would say medium. Like, it wasn't like I saw the dude and had never, I was like, hey, who are you? I mean, I this isn't lobotomizing, you know, memories or anything, but I do find that it blunted the edge of a compulsion. You know, I was feeling really hung up in the same way. Like, when you're aware of the fact that that all these hours spent pining, like, would be nice to have back, you know, and to put towards some like useful end. I do feel like I got a lot of my attention back, and although it still bothers me sometimes, I am not, you know, I'm not crying on it like I used to. Yeah.
Did you ever, as an artist, think if I fix what's broke, you know, I might break what I use to make art?
Yeah, I did. But you can think that for 3 years or for 5 years or for 8 years, and then after like 12 years, you're just like, this sucks. I don't like this feeling at all. Also, I think I'd written a lot of really great songs about the dude. I'm proud of the work I did, but I don't need 8 albums of that.
You performed for NPR's Tiny Desk Concert. I want to play a little bit of the sound of the song, The Man I Knew.
By the time that you told me, it was already plain that you changed. But your conscience was clean and as white as a line of cocaine.
When I hear that, I hear someone who was in love with an addict in some way.
Yep. Yeah, you're well researched. Yeah, you know, I'd been dating a guy who, I'm going to shy from the word addict, but who was doing a lot of drugs, and it freaked me out. You know, it was someone I thought I knew really, really well, and I wouldn't have been surprised if we were fighting. I wouldn't have been super surprised by feelings of conflict or friction with him, but I was surprised by a feeling of unfamiliarity. After having known him for so many years, I didn't expect that I'd ever walk into a room and feel estranged from him, but I did.
I don't know what that stuff does to you, and I don't know if it's real, but I spent a decade in love with you, and I can't tell if you're here. The man I knew.
We've been speaking with rapper, writer, poet, and performer Dessa. You can see her this Saturday at the House of Blues for Heavy and Light. It's a combination of talks and music to help people dealing with depression and suicide. Her new album, Sound the Bells, was recorded with the Minnesota Orchestra and will be out in November.